At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Delivering on the returns, increasing our margins.
Ratings go down the toilet if I'm not here.
All I do is simply put the math in my favor.
We agree that Brandon and John do good work.
The reason is simple wrestling economics.
Told the Netflix numbers, I've been told the metrics a little bit, probably five different times, I still don't get it.
There were respectable wrestling journalists who needed answers.
Thank you very much, members of the media. I hope you all go to hell.
How about we pop a number right here, right now?
The whole part of the show, man.
And here we are, Pollock and Thurston. Today's graphic. Brought to you by Brandon Thurston.
It's brought to you by the great graphics team here. We had a graphics team earlier in the run here. We have fired those people summarily, and we've replaced them with new, great, talented graphic designers.
Well, those are great efficiencies that you're creating, yes, at WrestleNomics HQ.
Right, right. That's part of the opportunity here.
Well, Brandon, it's officially NFL preseason time, and are you aware that Hard Knocks... the Buffalo Bills are getting the Hard Knocks treatment this coming
season. Heard that. I've not watched it. Much like WWE Unreal, I've not watched it.
Okay. That's your NFL portion of Pollock and Thurston. Stay tuned as we go into the regular season.
I heard James Cook, the running back who is in a contract dispute, he has at least started to attend practice, which is an accomplishment.
We're talking about practice.
Not a game.
We're talking about practice. A lot to talk about on today's show, everyone. We're going to discuss the latest going on involving Janelle Grant and Dr. Carlin Kolker with a hearing that went down this past Monday that Brandon was able to hack his way into. We're also going to talk about the TMZ documentary on Hulk Hogan featuring Vince McMahon, notwithstanding making a public appearance and things of that nature with Harvey Levin, as well as story that Brandon and I reported on this past week. WWE, they wanted to add a premium live event. They threw a dart at the calendar. It just happened to land on September 20th, the same night as AEW All Out. So we will be discussing the first main roster PLE event to go up against an AEW pay-per-view.
Yes, there's only like four or five Saturdays in any given month, so put your conspiracy theories away.
Yeah, I mean, don't make this a WWE versus AEW issue, okay? It's a very busy calendar. But we start off with the news that Paramount and Skydance, their merger complete, and within 48 hours, locking down a $7.7 billion deal with the UFC that will see all UFC numbered events and fight night cards going to Paramount Plus with a select simulcast on CBS. This will come with a average annual value of $1.1 billion, which doubles what the UFC was generating at ESPN. A big, big deal for the UFC, and one that has been pretty much like the top like sports media story of the week for sure. Not so much that the UFC was moving its rights package, but the fact that largely the entire UFC programming slate is going to one suitor, and the fact that they got such a high amount, and that it was Paramount of all places that landed all of these. I mean, there was thoughts of this being carved out among Netflix and ESPN. Maybe Paramount will get a piece, and that's where things were going. Paramount was talking about the Fight Night package, and then this merger is completed last week, and they decide to go all in and get the pay-per-view content, and now pay-per-view is dead. Or is it? It depends on which TKO executive you're listening to this past week, because boy, was this a headache for the TKO comms department, because we had Mark Shapiro saying one thing, Dana White saying the other, and fans just not knowing what the state of pay-per-view is.
Is there confusion? after last week's confusion around ESPN and whether or not you're going to get PLEs as part of your cable package. Is there so he said on CNBC, and David Faber was taken aback, that you're going to see all of the numbered, formerly called pay-per-view events right on CBS broadcast. We're going Tiffany product here. We're going Jimmy the Greek, and he set up a bunch of things from his past there to reminisce some memories. Yes. Does Dana White say otherwise?
So these are the competing statements that we got. Mark Shapiro and Ari Emanuel were on CNBC, and as Brandon mentioned, Mark Shapiro had stated that their big talking point was pay-per-view is an antiquated model. What's on pay-per-view these days anyway? And he was stating maybe all of the numbered events will be simulcast on CBS, which, as Dave Faber stated here, kind of like, what is the incentive to sign up for Paramount Plus if all these numbered events are on the CBS network?
We get Fight Night and probably other content, right?
Well, I mean, we didn't even get like a breakdown, but like the numbered events would be your top tier events that you would think would have the most value for someone to add that package. I mean, the fight nights are a nice compliment, but anyway, that same day, Dana White is stating, well, we're looking at four events to be simulcast, a bit of a difference between likely all and four. Then Dana White, speaking to the New York Post and then reiterating this afterwards, they did a contender series last night. He did a press conference after the fact that pay-per-view is not dead, that there could be a big fight that we could do on a pay-per-view, completely different from from Mark Shapiro's talking point.
UFC pay-per-view.
UFC pay-per-view.
Not Zuffa boxing.
No. No, he was stating like he kept saying pay-per-view is not dead. And the fact is they still have to sell pay-per-views this year. So Dana White is looking at this Saturday. Pay-per-view is not a dead model on Saturday night because we still want your $80 here for Dricus du Plessis and Hamzat Chimaev. Then today, Dana was on Barstool, again, reiterating pay-per-view is not dead. But then one of the co-hosts did state, but pay-per-view will not be part of this deal with Paramount. And he said yes and quickly moved on. So I think it is safe to say that it looks like UFC is out of the pay-per-view business. And if Dana White has this belief that after 7 years they can revisit pay-per-view, I think they will be sorely mistaken on that forecast. But dude, if you were paying attention to Mark Shapiro and Dana White over the last 48 hours, you would be so confused as the consumer as to what exactly this is. When the general sentiment and the selling point is for you, the fan, you're saving over $1,000 a year by getting Paramount Plus and all the events and not having to pay $80 a pay-per-view plus an ESPN Plus subscription.
So what is that? Almost $90 per month? And they're doing pay-per-views every month?
Yes. The total would come to, if you got ESPN Plus for the year and you get a bit of a savings on that, it came out to about $1,100 a year for all the UFC pay-per-view events. Now on Paramount Plus, the current pricing is $60 a year for the ad tier, $120 for the ad-free tier, which very likely we could see price increases because this deal is insane of what Paramount is taking on in terms of expenses here. But regardless, that represents,
I suppose, anything could be carved into a deal, but I can't imagine Paramount's getting all of it. There is no other domestic.
The only things remaining are like the Ultimate Fighter and Contenders series, very small pieces of the puzzle. But for live fight cards, this is pretty much it, including what were previously pay-per-views.
But imagine you're Paramount and you think you're getting all the numbered. Well, you're getting all the numbered pay-per-views, all the numbered events, and then they're going to do like the really big ones. Maybe that would be a pay-per-view. That sounds unlikely to me, but
who might
question Dana White?
I don't think that will be happening. I just was amazed that this company, like, they just had these competing messages coming out. Like, it wasn't just like a slight difference of opinion here. Like, they were two diametrically opposed talking points that just it was just very odd to see they were so out of sync with regards to just explaining this deal and doing the media rounds.
But anyway, as far as the partners that they've made deals with, whether it's WWE or UFC, almost all of these deals in the last couple of years have been a surprise to me in terms of who they made the deal with. whether it was SmackDown moving off of Fox. Not that I necessarily expected them to stay with Fox, but moving off of Fox and going to the USA Network, Raw not staying where it is, going to Netflix. We figured UFC would have to make a deal with ESPN and split the rights up, maybe between, I don't know, WBD or Netflix or someone, but no, going to Paramount that nobody was really talking about seriously. NXT going to the CW. So you do the roll call of media companies that TKO has just with UFC and WWE. And I think they've got everybody covered now except for Amazon and WBD. If you count Evolve as covering Foxes, we've got Netflix covered with Raw and international rights. You've got NBC Universal covered with SmackDown, even after that Peacock deal expires. You've got Paramount covered with UFC. I guess like there's some smaller things like Apple TV that I don't think is ever going to buy wrestling rights in any serious way. But they've really, you know, I don't know if there's exclusivity here. And there's probably not exclusivity on something like Paramount towards wrestling and vice versa, wrestling towards MMA. But it certainly does create a really strong partnership between a big media company and a big combat sports company when it comes to putting MMA or wrestling content on any of those existing partners. And I think it's notable that they're not with WBD because, you know, that's where AEW is. So there's no land to grab there, I guess. That's because somebody else has got it.
What do you think about this move for the UFC to get out of pay-per-view at this juncture for them? I mean, you have followed this and written about it as closely as anyone about the impact WWE received when it got out of pay-per-view. And there was criticism at the time, like, were you leaving pay-per-view, taking all your pay-per-views and putting them onto the network? At the same time, for the last 11 years, WWE fans, it's been more accessible than ever to get the biggest content, and that's going to be the case for UFC if these big shows will all be on Paramount Plus and some simulcast on CBS. Like, do you, and they're getting a huge amount for it as well. Like, it seems to be like you are out of the pay-per-view industry, which is very, very lucrative, but it's, you know, a calculated risk that this is not going to be something you have to revisit.
Yeah. Let's listen to what Mark Shapiro said. And Ari on CNBC the other day.
We wanted to get rid of the old model of pay-per-view. That's what TKO, as we envisioned it, a long time ago.
Why is pay-per-view the old model?
It's antiquated. It's just an antiquated model. What's on pay-per-view these days? Once in a while, a big-time boxing match that starts in the middle of the night, and or maybe some movies on DirecTV. It's an antiquated model, right? It's a wall. It's a barrier at the end of the day for our fans to get our product. This will be well received by our athletes, by our fans, and that was crucially important to Dana White.
I just want to say, before you give your reasoned analysis, that's the closest we probably got to me getting a clip of Mark Shapiro like talking about porn. Like, what's on pay-per-view these days? I mean, late at night, it's like Big Butts 11. I mean, that's our competition. Lot of churn.
No, AEW is still going to be in the pay-per-view business. And I don't think, you know, I mean, AEW just reworked their deal with WBD. And if somebody was going to pay AEW a sufficient amount of money to make them get out of pay-per-view, then they would have made such a deal. Yeah. But they're not. And I think AEW and everybody in the wrestling business below AEW, pay-per-view is probably still a pretty viable model. They're just not popular enough, as maybe WWE is just on the other side of it. I think it's ambiguous though. But most of the wrestling brands below WWE, it's probably just best for them to monetize that kind of peak event a la carte. But we have seen the benefits of putting your pay-per-view in front of putting your biggest events in front of a bigger audience, right? WWE Network, I think that helps their popularity downstream, helps their attendance, helps their TV ratings. And we look at when they put pay-per-views, not just on the WWE Network, but in front of an even bigger audience on Peacock. I think that helped reverse or stabilize the popularity decline that was happening in 2021. And we've heard Brandon Ross say many times, you know, maybe there's an opportunity here to make UFC even more popular if you put these biggest events on something as big as broadcast CBS. If you look at the other sports, it makes sense, right? Like, it's not like there's any history of the big team sports in the United States ever being on pay-per-view. I think you could, I mean, maybe globally, there's probably nothing like that except for in combat sports and in pro wrestling and boxing and MMA. It only makes sense to put the Super Bowl on broadcast TV. So maybe there's value in that. And if these networks are going to pay the money for it, why shouldn't they? Is UFC even getting a cut of the pay-per-views as they are on ESPN? Is that just guaranteed money? Is there any sort of incentive for them to perform well on pay-per-view versus the fight nights?
So, I mean, when the deal with ESPN was first announced, it was consistently reported that ESPN was paying a flat fee to the UFC. And it was not my understanding that if they hit like certain benchmarks, they were getting above and beyond that. So I don't know how much it's changing in terms of the incentive structure beyond like the incentive is to keep your partner satisfied with what you are bringing to the table for this gigantic fee. And obviously for Paramount Plus, like you crunch the numbers here. Like this is a deal that it's really hard to make any sense out of for Paramount, at least in the short term, where they have been trying to get their losses lower and lower. And this kind of just blows that out of the park now with this deal that they're taking on, and potentially another one that we'll talk about in the TKO family. So I think that the incentive structure is going to be interesting just to see what the makeup of these cards are. Like, are the numbered events still going to be structured in such a way that they feel like the big cards? Because in essence, you're being paid the exact same, and there's no difference between a UFC 350 and your next fight night card that's taking place in Vegas, for instance, at the Apex. Like, these are all kind of on similar ground. They're on the same platforms, and they all cost the same to your fan.
Well, there's a very important media relationship that you want to uphold and make as, you know, make your media partner as happy as possible. I guess thinking back to the W Network, I think the W Network gets framed sometimes as a failure by some. It cannibalized a lot of businesses. Obviously, it cannibalized pay-per-view. It also cannibalized DVDs, which were dying anyway. I think, you know, it's hard to tell because over those years from 2014 to 2021, there's a pretty decided popularity decline after the first few years, which I think did benefit from the great access to the pay-per-views and the access to the library. But I think, you know, after a few years of that, you had from about 2016 or 17 onwards, 2021, popularity declining. So the question of, you know, the basic question of like, would WWE be more profitable had they stayed in the pay-per-view business, is watered down by the genuine decline in popularity of WWE in the late 2010s. But if the product was more attractive to viewers, better, then they would have done better and probably would have been a little better on the whole, because they would have provided that content, the peak content, to as much as not as many people as possible, but a lot more people. And they would have had the tailwinds of that higher reach along with, the access to the content, that would have helped them in a lot of ways. But I guess I think it's probably a better move for them to be licensing that out to ESPN. Are they sort of back in a de facto pay-per-view business once they're on ESPN DTC, because you're going to have to pay, maybe depending on whether or not your carrier makes a deal. Maybe it's probable that YouTube TV, that Comcast will make deals probably before the first WWE PLE in 2026 that's on ESPN DTC. But there's probably
how many phone calls has YouTube TV and Comcast received over the last week from wrestling fans demanding that this carrier get a deal with ESPN fast, or I'm leaving.
Yeah. I even emailed Fubo PR and they didn't have a clear answer for me, even though they are on the list. I was trying to just confirm that, you know, what I was told about certain carriers, including Fubo, including Charter, but there wasn't clear communication, at least to one of these carriers was unsure if they were going to have it or not. I think they are going to have it. But you've got at this moment, until more carriage deals are renewed, there's about half the universe that currently doesn't have the rights to carry it, apparently, for free.
Brandon got varied responses this week with some of his phone calls. Maybe we'll talk about any sure. arenas that he contacted over the past week and how sure. they responded to him as well. That's still to come.
Yes.
Other aspects to this deal, of course, are, huge day for fighters, right? $7.7 billion. I mean, this is going to be life-changing for many of these 700 fighters that are under contract to the UFC because of
their... They're going to get paid more now, right?
It's a pivot. They made zero, give or take a penny, math off the top of my head, in the ESPN deal. And now under this deal, I can confirm they're getting zero. So that is... But Dana White has stated, hey, obviously the bonuses are going to go up. The bonuses that are at the discretion of the UFC, which, to remind non-UFC fans, these fight night bonuses, fight of the night bonuses, $50,000. So, I mean, could we see $75,000 bonuses given out each week? I mean, that...
They should be grateful if they get that.
For the low-end fighters, I mean, you're probably... They would not have been expecting much here. But the larger question is your top-end fighters, where a significant amount of your pay is tied to pay-per-view points. And if you're out of the pay-per-view business, we are right back in 2014, where a lot of WWE talent were questioning, hey, what happens to our pay-per-view payoffs? Because that is the incentive for us to reach a top spot and headline a pay-per-view. And, you know, the thought at the time was they would come up with their own system to keep those names happy. But this is this is something I guarantee you none of the fighters were clued into this ahead of time, and it could very well impact them financially.
Take care of the top talent and everything goes fine, right? Because nobody's going to get together and push against management. And they are getting paid well relative to the median person, so they should just be happy to be there.
Just be happy to be there. I mean, if you can get a UFC spot and you're getting 20 and 20, that should more than suffice for a company that's going to be now entering this nearly $8 billion deal.
So who's the top MMA competitor to UFC? PFL and Bellator are emerging?
They have
merged.
Yeah, PFL is basically your number two competitor, and I would say a really, really distant number two. But they have a deal with ESPN. They could have some unintended boost from this deal if ESPN wants to stay in the MMA business. PFL is their promotion.
Paramount used to own Bellator, correct?
Paramount, yeah. When it was Viacom, they owned the majority of Bellator.
So what's to stop ESPN from not covering UFC anymore and just really boosting PFL?
There's nothing. There's nothing to stop them from that. The only thing that will stop them is if they feel UFC is just such a part of the mainstream sports news cycle that we can't ignore the UFC. But I promise you, you are not going to see the level of coverage on a week-by-week basis that ESPN had been providing before. I think they have to cover the biggest events that are newsworthy, but I imagine like you're going to see and that is something you're leaving. Like, you are going from ESPN to what is going to be a lower reach for, even with all the more subscribers Paramount Plus has, the direct sports fans that ESPN was broadcasting to and attaching themselves to online. Like, that is something you are giving up in this deal.
And does this, as somebody who doesn't watch UFC hardly at all, are you seeing a lot of like ESPN Bet being pushed on screen? Does this hurt that sports betting business for ESPN by not having the UFC broadcasts next year?
Yeah, it's a good point. There's like that's a heavy component of like the UFC broadcast is pushing that aspect of things, and I'm sure that was something that Paramount was looking at as like that being a lucrative portion of this business that we can monetize through. Like ESPN's response to this, like Jimmy Pitaro was, you know, and Dana White too, they were very complimentary of one another, and it's not out of the realm that ESPN could continue with the Contender Series or Ultimate Fighter, have some loose connection to the UFC at this point. But it's going to be very interesting to see like what level of engagement Paramount can place upon the UFC, as opposed to vice versa, where we're looking at this as like UFC is bringing all of this attention to Paramount Plus that was sort of this fledgling streaming service that was out of the top tier of streaming services that people were looking at, and now they're making this big splash by overspending.
So they still have maybe some side content to deal here, including Ultimate Fighter. Does this mean that we might see Pancrase on Paramount Plus? Where's the library going to go?
This
this where am I going to be able to watch Ken Wayne Shamrock versus Max Katsifunaki?
I think that ESPN, I think the time is now for Stephen A. Smith to have a Pancras special.
I would
love
that.
Every Saturday morning on ESPN The Ocho.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. That is the UFC Paramount deal. Much more to this. We should also tack on to this. The front office sports is reporting that Paramount is not done yet with TKO. It looks like they could be the ones to land the Zuffa boxing contract. No estimated value of this deal was reported by front office sports, but Dana White had stated that, you know, the deal is pretty much done, but he would not disclose with who. And I guess until this is official, we will keep an open mind. But I mean, it does tell you, like, Paramount, they, since this merger has closed, they are going all in to try and make themselves a big player, even if in the short term. I mean, it was very interesting to see the reaction of the TKO stock to this deal earlier this week with UFC and the Paramount Skydance stock that did not respond as positively to it. But look at that.
It's still going up today. It was at 180, I think, the day that this deal was announced. Now it's up over 190.
Yeah, they were like at 164 before this deal was announced. So look at that. We're looking at a, you know, $27 increase this week, which includes Vince McMahon as well. So he did just fine.
Vince sold all the shares, didn't he? Vince sold all the shares. That's what I hear on all the podcasts I listen to.
That's not true, Brandon. He still has a...
But I watched the Netflix documentary. The Netflix documentary produced by Bill Simmons could not be wrong. He sold all of his shares, correct?
More on Vince McMahon, and maybe even a little of Bill Simmons a little later on.
Okay.
Is pay-per-view dead, Brandon? Are you officially carving out the gravestone for pay-per-view?
No, it's still a valuable instrument for something with a relatively small audience, but a very passionate audience, such as wrestling fans of these more niche products. And maybe AEW is just on the cusp of that. Maybe as time goes on, it'll become more sensible for them to license that. But they didn't, and they just renewed the deal some 9 months ago, and WBD wasn't willing to pay them a guaranteed fee for it. And hey, by the way, when are AEW pay-per-views going to become available on HBO Max? Still hasn't happened. Still waiting for that. Working out the technology up there, I'm sure.
Well, we're going to see how viable pay-per-view is on September the 20th, because AEW will have its all-out event from Toronto. And as we reported this week, WWE staging its main roster, PLE, the same night, which is scheduled to take place in Indianapolis, Indiana. The significance of this will be, we have not confirmed the start time, but we are led to believe this will be a head-to-head contest. The first time WWE has put a main roster PLE directly against a AEW pay-per-view. And of course, the big differentiating factor here is it's a $50 AEW pay-per-view against a WWE PLE that is going to be streaming on Peacock.
What's the reason for doing this? I mean, like, what's the benefit? Obviously, it's to put on a big show and to compete against AEW to some extent. But what do you really gain from that? And why is it worth... You're going to be impacted a little bit, because you're going against another major wrestling show. It's as big as it gets anyway. You're by far the biggest. But it would be more ideal, just for your own gross interests, to do it on some day where there's not another big wrestling event. So what do you really gain if you're WWE from hurting AEW or something like that?
I don't think this is a move that WWE is making that is going to be some kind of death knell on AEW. But I think it is... Like, we have introduced this friction by just throwing these NXT shows out there, which have had basically no noticeable impact on AEW shows. So now we're ramping it up to a main roster show that I think will cost AEW some buys. I don't know how many, but I think it will hurt them to a degree.
Is the deal, the Peacock deal, now being a lame duck? You know you're going ESPN. So right. Is there less pressure to, like, make your partner happy because your partner is not renewing these rights? So now we can really put the big gun against AEW.
It's a good point. I mean, if I'm Peacock, like, I'm looking at it from that vantage point of, hey, these are, if we're looking at the pie of wrestling fans on a Saturday night, even if it's like, you know, we're it's going to be a small percentage that are choosing AEW over us. We could have this night to ourselves and maximize the amount of people tuning in. I think if you're WWE, though, it's putting our product front and center. It's at a lower price point. And I think as well, like, if you are able to convince, say, 15% of potential AEW pay-per-view buyers to skip the AEW show, I think that's a meaningful habit you want to create in fans, that they can skip a show, get the cheaper alternative that is a WWE show, and you get out of the habit of buying your monthly AEW show. And I do not think this will be the last time that WWE does this. As long as they have the ability to do so, I think, like, you should expect this kind of strategy from AEW. And if I was AEW, I wouldn't look at this as just like some one-off for a month either. I think they have to look at them at the potential of the, and the fact is we're just over a month out. They have not officially announced this show. And I think they wanted to keep this as close to, like, what is the latest we can announce this show to put tickets on sale and the least amount of chance for anyone to, make any kind of a defensive move.
What defensive move can be made? Like, if you're AEW and I learn about this a week or a month earlier than otherwise,
is there less time? Like, there's nothing preventing AEW in theory from, like, they did
the date,
with
I guess, or moving to the afternoon.
You could move it to the afternoon. Like, that is the option they did in Texas. And I would say, like, the pay-per-view buys were probably not too impacted by this. That's about your only move, and I don't know how much AEW is going to react to this, because the moves are limited. Like, that's about all you could do is move it to the afternoon.
I guess in terms of PR, social media chatter, like, as you guys mentioned the other night, a lot of the response, at least to us publishing the story, was a lot of criticism towards WWE, whether because AEW fans see WWE as this bully, or because they would like to not have to, you know, choose one or the other. They would like to watch both, whatever. Is like part of it that, well, it's an AEW pay-per-view, which are almost always really well received, if very long. Is putting your own big show that's going to create its own, you know, naturally much larger social media response and wrestling discussion to dominate the wrestling discussion. Is that a significant thing to think about in terms of, you know, sort of blocking out or competing with this reception of a really good show, probably, that a lot of people are going to like and positively receive? Is it worth it to put a big WWE show in the way of that to try to prevent any, you know, is that a meaningful thing to do, to try to block and, you know, impede this positive fan momentum that they might get out of putting on a good show, I guess?
I think there's a degree of that as well. The idea of just, like, in this environment where WWE has this guaranteed revenue, like, it's like, you're not necessarily competing for to sell tickets. You're not really attached to how many subscribers Peacock is adding. It's like these wins are like, it's like winning the night. And if that's winning on social media, if that's winning in the amount of attention that you can receive for your big moments, your big, like, whether it's a Cena heel turn or a Brock Lesnar coming back, it's like, these are the things you are aiming for your audience so that you are, like, the dominant conversation that night. And I think this is going to be the goal. I don't at all see this WWE show being just some run of the mill show. I imagine they are going to load this one up for that exact purpose, that we are going to win the night, and AEW show is going to be the secondary show that is harmed by this. And we're selling our show at a fraction of the cost as well. That, even if you're someone that, like, enjoys both products, it's like, that's a much easier sell of, like, $50 versus a Peacock subscription. And if you watch a WWE, a lot of people were just saying, hey, I'm just going to watch one and then I'm going to watch the other. There will be those people that are just going to consume all of this. But a lot of, like, just, I hate to use the term regular people, but, I mean, the average person is going to watch
civilians.
They're going to watch one show, and that's going to be their fill of wrestling. And after watching 3 hours of WWE, are not going to want to spend $50 or even go find a stream of a 5-hour show and watch that until the early hours of Sunday. Like, some will watch both, but others won't. And that's, I think, And that alone is a win for WWE. There's no real harm for WWE in doing this other than people perceiving them as the bully, which I think is a distinction that they have willingly took on in this whole pattern that everyone has seen emerge. Going back 6 years, this has been the MO of the company.
Because, like, purely in terms of from a financial aspect, Tony Khan and his family are billionaires, and this is a passion project for Tony Khan. He's not about to stop running this business because they're going to sell 20% fewer pay-per-view buys per year or something like that. It seems like the calculus, if it's rational, has to be about the media exposure that comes from these events, I think. Large part of it, anyway.
Part of it is, like, this strategy where I think we can both agree, like, it feels like this year they have taken on more, WWE, that is, has been much more aggressive in this. And I question, like, was the time to be going this hard, like, 18 months ago when they were in the negotiations for their next television deal and harming them at every turn so that they could be as wounded as possible going into their renewal talks? Because at this point, yeah, like, Brandon, they will probably cost them, like, some buys here. But this is not going to be this is not going to harm AEW in the long term. It's, you know, it's something that they may have to contend with as, like, the new normal of pay-per-view competition that they might have to look at. But, like, they are locked into this deal with WBD, and pay-per-view is a portion of their revenue, but it's not the be-all, end-all either.
Yeah. And as I was mentioning earlier with the addition of this UFC deal with Paramount and TKO covering all these major media companies with the large exceptions of WBD, which is where AEW is, and Amazon, which has no major wrestling partner. It was like OVW on Amazon Prime or something for a minute. But it's easy to craft a narrative of TKO being this really dominant, almost monopolistic, you know, property that or business that's really, you know, going after at least AEW. I don't know about PFL, but not only are you dominating almost all of the potential media partners that a potential wrestling competitor could partner with, but you're also directly going against their biggest shows of the year. These are companies that have had their own antitrust issues. UFC is still in the process of settling two antitrust lawsuits. WWE settled a lawsuit with MLW over antitrust allegations for $20 million. You're buying AAA. You're doing something with TNA. There's speculation that WWE or TKO might end up owning TNA. Just the power in the wrestling space that's being amassed here for WWE to get in the way of any potential competitor, and indeed to go after their strongest competitor, it's becoming overwhelming. And if AEW, it wouldn't be surprising someday, I guess, for AEW to sue WWE, I think, over antitrust allegations, particularly if there's more to this in terms of, we've heard, you know, allusions by Tony Khan over the years to contract tampering, whether that's a real legal issue or not. It wouldn't surprise me if there are other things that AEW could allege in terms of other partnerships that come with running a show. We know that through the through some of the records requests I've made, there's at least one case where WWE did have an exclusivity agreement on a venue. It's opening WWE up to at least the perception that it's a bully in this space to a group of fans who favor AEW at the very least.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let us move on to the Hulk Hogan documentary that aired on Tuesday night on Fox, and this was noteworthy because of the fact that this was Vince McMahon's first public interview since leaving WWE in January of 2024 after the complaint was filed by Janelle Grant. Others interviewed included Jimmy Hart, Bill Goldberg, Mick Foley, Sylvester Stallone, Dave Meltzer was on this, as well as several WWE talents that they obviously they sent the camera to at one of the Hogan tributes and just did some really quick, clips with like Charlotte Flair and Raquel Rodriguez, Alexa Bliss and others. So the Vince McMahon interview, I think, was the portion that everyone was most interested in hearing from. And we got to, and for those going in expecting this was just going to be a glossed over hagiography of Hulk Hogan, they spent a lot more time on the racism aspect and the sex tape than I expected them to. I would say the last 15, 20 minutes of this hour-long documentary was focused on that. And we got Vince McMahon reacting to the racist language uttered by Hulk Hogan on that tape and the company's reaction back in 2015.
He had some big missteps in his life, notably the sex tape with some racist comments.
It was unforgivable. And I was like, aghast. What happened? And when those things occurred, that's not like him. What in God's name is going on?
What in God's name is going on? So Vince McMahon's defense was, first of all, they cut Hulk Hogan in 2015, bring him back in 2018, where Vince McMahon states that he knew Hulk Hogan was not a racist. He said some racist things, but he is not a racist. And that was his kind of, understanding of the Hulk Hogan.
Racist to an extent.
Racist to a point, as Terry Bollea stated on the tape. There's a point he won't go to, but, dropping the N-word multiple times on a tape when he's not realizing he's being filmed, that is not the point that he is not willing to cross.
Now, he did apologize and say that he's not a racist after the fact. I think what Mark Henry has said in this documentary, right, that he encouraged Hogan to join him, Mark Henry,
He disclosed he went to both Hogan and Vince about this. So he did give the timeline of when this occurred, that, hey, if you want this backlash to lessen, let's go on a tour of black colleges and talk about it. And Henry conveyed that Hogan said he's been advised not to talk about this any longer. And Mark Henry, I thought Mark Henry came off pretty balanced in this piece. He stated, listen, I was a giant fan of this guy. I loved him growing up, but I can't sit here and defend a man who openly stated he was racist. And added that suggestion as well, which Hogan rebuffed at the time. And this did follow him. This followed him dramatically for the last 10 years of his life and right up until and including his death, obviously. And it also came to a front at the Netflix premiere of Raw back in January, where Hulk Hogan famously came out. He was booed. Jimmy Hart just going into panic mode, said, I'm just waving the flag. I'm just waving that flag. And Vince McMahon tuned in. We learned that Vince McMahon did figure out Netflix that night because he did tune in. He at least saw this clip in some form or fashion, and he reacted to the vociferous boos that Hulk Hogan received that night at the Intuit Dome.
For someone who had WWE in their blood, as you did, I'm just wondering how you reacted to that.
Well, it wasn't set up properly. I'm sure he was probably despondent after that.
How do you feel when you heard that?
I was angry. Because, we've known each other for a lifetime, professionally and personally. And setting up, so to speak, this larger-life superhero, and you just let him walk out there, he deserves something very, very special. And more than anyone, they owe him. It's like, okay, and here comes Hulk Hogan. I got angry because that's not the way that I would have done it, and he deserved much more.
That was an interesting comment. It was Vince McMahon not so much taking it negatively towards the fans, but rather how Hogan was presented to the fans, that he
was just put out there to promote a product.
It was not like he was even brought into the ring. It was not something built up. He came out for a product placement for Real American Beer.
There was no angle. There was nothing that predisposed the audience to cheer for him, except for the fact that he's Hulk Hogan.
It's like, here's a cold appearance by Hulk Hogan to just, and I don't think an insignificant part of this is the fact that it was such a blatant just commercial that we were watching in the midst of Raw. But ultimately, like, it was an audience that I think just a totality of things. It was like, here is the start of this new era for WWE. And this was an audience that was collectively stating, we do not need this guy from the past because of all of these aspects of the man's life. It all kind of just culminated in this scene, and it ended up being the story coming out of this Netflix premiere. But, you know, Vince McMahon has been exceptionally quiet during this last year and a half. And of course, we do know, like, the forcing himself back onto the board. I don't think anyone is burying their head in the sand to not believe that there has been friction along this way between WWE and Vince McMahon.
Is he criticizing Paulovic's creative?
I mean, how else can you take this as, like, that's the be all end all here is who is running this show. It is Paul Levesque. And then there
complicated
was
a relationship.
Relationships are complicated. Yes. Then there is the Hulk Hogan tribute on Raw from a couple of weeks back, and Harvey Levin asking Vince McMahon about his absence from the 10 bell salute.
When the wrestling world gave Hulk the 10 bell salute, you had such history and such a deep friendship. You must be having such mixed emotions that you weren't there to be part of that. I just, it really struck me that way.
Struck me that way as well.
Struck me that way as well. I will also add here, I have no doubt that Vince McMahon being exceptionally selective of where he has spoken or not spoken since leaving the company. It was just such an elephant in the room that we're talking about this formerly praised star in Hulk Hogan and all this baggage that has impacted his legacy to large amounts of the public. And here's Vince McMahon to ask his reaction and how we are not making some kind of equivalency to Vince McMahon, who is now outside of this company as well. But I imagine
it's worth knowing that his car accident was that story was broken by TMZ also.
That's true. That is true as well. And we didn't get an update on the car accident.
He's not due in court for a couple of weeks for his alleged reckless driving.
Yeah. He might have his birthday party the same week as his court appearance. But I mean, to me, I think you read between the lines there that Vince would have gladly accepted an invitation and WWE obviously not extending one for obvious reasons. But to me, also less obvious reasons, given some of TKO's decisions and the idea of Vince McMahon certainly wanting to be part of WWE in some form or fashion, I think was very evident in this clip. And the fact that he didn't just put on a happy face in this interview as, you know, just quietly endorsing WWE. And I mean, he could have just come on and just said, you know, he did not have to take these jabs at WWE, but he did.
He resigned more than once. Remember, he felt that he had got bad advice. And so he forced his way back into the company in early 2023. Ultimately, the lawsuit made him resign again. And I'm sure there were pressures, not only from sponsors, but perhaps from, you know, the major TKO executives as well. I wouldn't, any of you guys have talked about it. When the Grant case is over with, whenever that happens, however that resolves, depending on, unless like Vince gets a judgment against him in a jury trial or something like that for the public to see, I wouldn't rule out if he lives long enough, he's about to be 80 years old. I wouldn't rule it out that he comes back to WWE in person in some form. In some sort of, I mean, Hall of Fame or something like that.
Like, do you disagree? Because Wei and I talked about this. Like, if the day comes, Vince McMahon passes away, is his handling on WWE any different than Hulk Hogan's?
No. There will be no focus on the negative, and there will be, you know, it will be with Hogan. Yeah.
Life is complicated, but we are here because of this man. He created all of this. That will be the central talking point. And if
what is the appropriate way to do it for both Hogan and Vince, if you're WWE?
For WWE, I don't even have like the right answer. It would certainly be impossible for them to not acknowledge it. I wouldn't expect WWE to do any kind of like introspection of any of it. And I'm certain for them that they look at this whole Hulk Hogan thing as, listen, we're going to do the same thing if Vince McMahon were to pass. And what would the reaction of the fan base be? Would it be all that different than what we have just gone through now? And if so, like, again, it's weighing the of like, what is the value of Vince McMahon being inside of TKO versus being outside of TKO, shares notwithstanding. And I say that because we went through this song and dance once of Vince apparently leaving and then returning. And we go to 2023 when Nick Khan was on with Bill Simmons. And this was the thought process at the time of what you do in these situations and how the public responds.
So I think it was always my point of view, always Stephanie's point of view. At some point, he would come back. I think the way that he played it to me was smart, Bill, in that he went away for 5-6 months, which people, meaning the audience, seems to like when somebody does that. And he came back and took control back of his company as a control shareholder. But whenever the Ray Rice stuff happened in the NFL 8-10 years ago, whatever that was, and there were conversations at that point, not your point of view, not my point of view, that, oh, is Roger Goodell going to resign? If you remember, he had a lot of heat on.
Yeah.
And I think you and I both concluded to each other, well, no advertiser has fled. Ratings aren't down. The product seems to continue to build. Why would he resign? Why would he do that? So I think that's more, keep in mind, I've lived in Los Angeles. I think, how long have you been in LA now, Bill?
20 years.
So I've been here since 2000. So 22, 23 years. Sometimes I think it's just a 3-mile radius of LA thing. The, hey, step down and,
yeah,
you know, you have to sort of be punished for it. It didn't used to be that way. So I think for somebody like Vince, there's something about the founder CEO that sees the vision, sort of sees the future, can get there a moment in time before others can, and then everyone else catches up. I think it's the same thing for Vince as a founder CEO. It's his company. So to me, WWE's Vince, Vince is WWE, and you know, we're going to do the best we can to keep building the company.
I never even put the two together about the 3-mile radius line from Nick Khan and the site of Raw on Netflix back in January as well.
It's true. This is just 3-mile radius that would boo Hulk Hogan. In other settings, he would not have been booed so roundly, I think. Yeah.
And I have zero doubt in my mind that if that Vince McMahon theme aired at just about any venue, I think it
especially
would be,
as a surprise, if it wasn't something surprise, that was looming.
Exactly. As a surprise, it would be no different than the same reaction Brock Lesnar received and any big star returning, it would receive. And
it's worth noting that they have positioned Brock as a heel. So whatever negative reaction he gets can be spun as just playing into the dynamic that they're trying to create.
Yeah. I mean, but again, it like a Vince McMahon comes back. It's a big celebratory return pop that he gets. And Paul Heyman can state, listen, you can't cancel Vince McMahon. The audience, I'm happy that Brock's back because the fans are. If the fans rejected him, then so would I. But the audience has spoken, and that's who we play to. That's the paying audience.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll, I think once we'll see how the Grant story plays out and how that lawsuit plays out. We've got a lot of one side of the story and not that much of the other. But the allegations are much more numerous against Vince than they are Brock.
Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just one that I certainly look at. Again, it's weighing the value. Like if you're within TKO, is like, what is the value of a Brock Lesnar who we are paying and we are not getting anything out of? He can be of value to us. Can they say the same about a Vince McMahon of, okay, we could bring this guy back. What is the value of bringing Vince McMahon back at this stage of the game?
Like I said last week, I think it's interesting to think about how, and I think this applies to wrestling in many ways, whether it's DVR viewership, what portion of the audience is watching on DVR versus live versus other sports where it's almost completely one way versus entertainment, in that wrestling is this thing that's overlapping both of these spaces. In sports, there's a higher tolerance for this. There's also some transparency about how we're dealing with it. But in entertainment, somebody like Kevin Spacey can't really find work. But it's wrestling. It's kind of I think the culture and the history legacy of wrestling is, you know, it's kind of sleazy anyway. So we don't really, we're not really that opposed to letting people back in or having, you know, strict standards for how we deal with these types of things. Hulk Hogan has been advised not to even address the racist comments, just ignore it. And that's been the history of wrestling. And I guess what I'm saying is, you know, this is clearly leaning more towards sports in that, well, our fans really aren't going to push back that hard on it versus if this was some other entertainment field like Hollywood movies, where maybe people just have a different sense of morality and politics, that there would be a harsher pushback to this, even though ultimately they're all ultimately answering to a mass audience.
This past Monday, there was a hearing in Connecticut involving Janelle Grant's legal team with legal representatives for Dr. Carlin Kolker and his clinic, Peak Wellness. What did we learn from this hearing on Monday? What has been granted and what has not?
So this is separate. I always want to point out this is a separate case from the more high profile case that we're following, which is in federal court against Vince McMahon and WWE. This is a separate, not quite lawsuit case between Janelle Grant against Dr. Carlin Kolker and his clinic that she says that she was directed by Vince McMahon to go get treatment at. She alleges that she was given unmarked pills, supplements, and given IV infusions that she says she wasn't informed what the substance of those infusions were. Dr. Kolker has denied this all vehemently. So we're at the point where Kolker tried to get this thrown out, tried to get this case dismissed. Grant is trying to obtain evidence. Particularly, there's this disagreement about whether or not she's been given all of her medical records from the clinic. Kolker says he has given Grant the records multiple times. Grant says that there are inconsistencies. There are things missing from the records. It was even suggested in this hearing that these records may have been altered. So what Grant is trying to get ultimately from this case at this point is evidence so that maybe she can sue Dr. Kolker. This is something you can do in Connecticut court. So what was decided here is she's also submitted filings requesting to depose Dr. Kolker and to depose some of his staff, to interview them under oath about what happened here. The judge said, no, there's no reason to do that yet, given that there's no lawsuit here. This is just a bill of discovery. So the only reason why you would in other such cases, why you would be allowed to depose someone is because the deponent, the person to be deposed is ill, is old age. Maybe they're not going to be alive for much longer. So you can depose them maybe in that case. The judge said, I don't see anything here why we can't just do these depositions down the road. But the judge said, I will grant your requests for documents. They've requested the medical records, which Kolker says he's already given to her. The judge urged them to work out whatever disagreements they have amongst themselves, but also granted the request from Grant to get the communications records. So that's kind of the big piece here is maybe as a result of this, maybe now they're going to get communications records involving the clinic and WWE and or Vince McMahon, to what extent there are such communications records. Now Kolker's side is in all likelihood going to object to this.
Of course.
So we're seeing, you know, sort of what everybody sort of stereotypically thinks of the legal system. It's this long drawn out process. What really changed here? We just inched along towards Grant getting some of the evidence that she wants.
Do you get the sense from this hearing that they can at least agree on what the documents are? That it just seems like that's been the source of contention here. It's like, we've given you all the relevant records and they're arguing, well, no, these are incomplete. Like, is there at least an agreement at the end of what these documents are?
For one thing, these are medical records. It's not like these are exhibits that we're being allowed to see. They're private medical records. So without being able to see what it is that Grant Sye is pointing to say that these are inconsistent or incomplete, I don't know. The judge suggested that maybe there's some misunderstanding between the parties about what the billing process is at the clinic. Maybe you can clear that up. Kolker's lawyer, who is present at this hearing, which is over Zoom or Microsoft Teams, said that, you know, we'll look again to see what might be considered a medical record and try to, we'll give you the records again, basically, is what he said, and look at whether there's anything else that we should give you. So that'll happen. The judge really urged them to work it out themselves. If they have to, they'll have another hearing, I suppose.
Which has gone smoothly so far. So I imagine they'll sit down and just figure out all of this confusion.
The judge was pretty emphatic. I mean, as a non-lawyer, maybe there is some pressure now on Kolker to be more giving here with these records than they have been up to this point. But clearly, their side of the story is we've given you everything you wanted multiple times. There will probably be objections to the notion that Grant should get all these communications records. Kolker's side has said that you're asking for way more than you would need to bring a lawsuit against us. So we're not giving you any of this. And I imagine they're going to do something to the effect of saying that, you know, you'd have to try to get that in an actual lawsuit, not in a bill of discovery, which made me consider, like, why did they file this as a bill of discovery in the first place and not just a lawsuit? I suppose because they wanted evidence first that they could get without risking that their case would just be dismissed initially. So I imagine this is a strategic move on the side of Grant's attorneys to get evidence. And clearly this evidence could help them in the event that their big federal case is sent to arbitration and perhaps get evidence quicker than it would if this was a traditional lawsuit. Again, if you go to arbitration, commensurate with the NDA that is the subject of the federal case, there's going to be very limited access to evidence and to discovery. But if you get evidence here, that becomes part of the public record in some form. Maybe that helps Grant's case in arbitration.
And we also have a defamation case that is ongoing that Kolker has filed against Ann Callis and her law firm as well.
Yes, that is in the earliest stages of these three cases that tangentially involve Vince McMahon and Janelle Grant. Now, remember, too, we've mentioned in previous iterations of reporting on this Kolker case is that one of the document requests that Grant has made is these plain travel logs allegedly involving some travel that supposedly Vince and Kolker made to Tijuana, Mexico. So that is included in the document requests that the judge approved.
Maybe they were going to see some lucha.
Maybe lucha. I've heard there's some good lucha in Tijuana.
Maybe they just got some masks and, you know, they just want to go down, check out some non-sports entertainment. All right, a few more stories here. Brian Curtis of The Ringer spoke with Jimmy Pitaro earlier this week about the WWE deal with ESPN and the topic of the outstanding WWE library that remains up for grabs once the Peacock deal is up.
And WWE still has a big library of events going back to the 80s and I think beyond at Peacock. Is that something you'd be interested in bidding on in the future?
Yeah, we're always interested in content of that quality. I will tell you that we will have the archival rights for the events that we are airing. But yes, in terms of their library, we certainly would be interested if and when those rights are available.
Follow up, Jimmy. Are you familiar with New Jack and his run in Smoky Mountain Wrestling? Are you looking at Mid-South, in particular, the Rat Pack era? Any of those that could be coming to ESPN Plus?
Roddy Piper versus Bad News Brown from WrestleMania 6. The moment where a certain moment in a mid-2000s WWE pay-per-view where Vince McMahon encountered, I think, Booker T and made some comments.
Yeah. Could we have a chapter on blackface as one of the tiles on ESPN Plus? Certainly has been brought up.
He makes it sound like clearly the library and the PLEs are on the same term. It makes it sound like it's a separate term. Like they couldn't have negotiated for that at the same time they negotiated for the PLEs. I don't see why they wouldn't be able to, given that they probably expire at about, if not exactly, the same time.
Yeah. And Yeah. As we mentioned last week, like you do have this WWE library, and more pressing is like the NXT events that are going to find a home somewhere. And those are not part of this ESPN deal as well. So maybe this is where they corner the market. They will get Amazon, and they'll get all they'll just get all the remaining outlets between all of these different packages.
Yes.
Final things here. Let's look at some Netflix and the viewership notes. So this was interesting. Week two, WWE Unreal was not ranked. It was out of the top 10 in every country that I could find. So it did not seem to have the lasting impact beyond the opening week.
Big Raw number, though, following SummerSlam.
That is true. They did 3 million global views for last Monday's show coming off of SummerSlam. And this would be their highest since when, Brandon?
Since the second week after WrestleMania? Let's look. Since April 28th, when they also reported 3.0 million.
Yeah, so, views. I mean, it would tell you the John Cena turn and whatever impact they had. I mean, there was probably a lot of curiosity coming off the, you know, you did the angle with Seth and you did the return of Brock, and that did get a lot of attention, and probably, you know, the follow-up, there was more curiosity than usual for an episode of Raw between those.
Paul Heyman was right. Fans want to see it.
That's it. Who is Paul Heyman to stand in the way of what the fans want?
Yeah, I heard some chatter that, you know, Dynamite did a good rating after SummerSlam. Maybe they could make a narrative that, well, people must have been mad that Brock Lesnar came back to WWE.
So maybe they thought Brock would show up at Dynamite.
So they put two TVs on when they watched Dynamite. Well, I mean, the Raw did a good rating after SummerSlam,
too. You're
going
to need two TVs to follow WWE and AEW. So you should invest in those dual screens. It's the only way you're going to follow these two companies. Yes. SmackDown on Friday did 1,557,000 viewers and a 0.48 second on television for the night in the demo behind the NFL preseason. Very good number for SmackDown. This was equal to the demo they did 2 weeks ago for that Hogan, like the night after Hogan's passing. So, I mean, it was this was a very hot crowd in Montreal, Quebec. Collision Saturday night, 423,000 viewers, a 0.08 11th. In prime time on cable. This went up against more NFL preseason and a UFC fight night card from the Apex in Las Vegas. This was their highest viewership since June 21st to tune in for the live show from Roanoke, Virginia.
Yeah, I've been looking. So we've looked at how AEW's ratings have, if anything, stabilized while they've also been simulcast since the new year on HBO Max. And so what has been a multi-year decline in some consumer metrics for AEW has seemed to stabilize or even gone in a positive direction for whatever reason, right? That's a good thing for AEW. And I think there's been, at least, you know, there's online a lot of negativity or criticism more so than before towards WWE, given whatever, Brock Lesnar for one thing. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an urge, what is it I used to call it, economic justice. We want to will a punishment upon this company for its bad behavior. But I'm still not seeing that in the ratings, looking at, especially since, you know, we're almost 1 year since all these network changes, SmackDown from Fox to USA, NXT from USA to CW, and just looking at the monthly averages that they've been doing compared to the very earliest months of those programs, putting aside the big premieres. The SmackDown is doing pretty evenly to what it was doing a year ago on USA Network. And I'm seeing, you know, the attendances are still quite strong according to WrestleTix numbers. So both companies are doing pretty well when it comes to fan engagement.
You mean fans are enjoying both products?
Maybe not the same fans. I'm sure those fans hate each other, but they are enjoying their respective products.
We do have a super chats here. Jake from the Windy City. Jim Cornette is keeping the pay-per-view business alive. He's always just been ordering WWE PLEs in the traditional way on his Spectrum cable. Okay, well, there you go. I mean, there will be some that, just don't, they're used to the tried and true method. He says the concern about UFC is how different the numbered events will be than the fight night cards and how they will keep them unique. I mean, I think it's to their advantage to still make these numbered shows feel special, because I don't think you want to eliminate like a tiered system and just make them all feel the same. I think no different than like WWE wanting to differentiate its like tiered content so that when these deals come up, you can package them together, as opposed to everything is an episode of Raw or everything is just a Fight Night card. I think you want to be able to, you know, segregate and make these numbered shows still feel special, because there's incentives to do so.
Yeah. I think these companies do have some self-control when it comes to that, especially when their biggest media partners are involved.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another edition of Pollock and Thurston. We are here each and every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern time on the Post Wrestling and WrestleNomics feeds. And you can follow all of Brandon's work at WrestleNomics.com, Patreon.com/WrestleNomics, and on Substack as well, where he is constantly churning out more and more without churn, because the people are just, they're jumping on the WrestleNomics bandwagon by the week.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah. When are your rights up for renewal?
We have no agreement with any major media partner, in fact. So we're always open for business.
Okay. Well, you can go direct to consumer on a weekly basis here. PostWrestlingCafe.com is where you can catch all of our added shows. We're doing reviews of WWE Unreal. We're through two episodes of that. And I will be back tonight with Wei Ting right after Dynamite here on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel. All right. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We're back next Wednesday. Goodbye.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.